John Grubby, who was short and stout and troubled with religious doubt, refused about the age of three to sit upon the curate's knee. And so the eternal strife must rage between the spirit of the age and dogma, which, as is well known, does simply hate to be outgrown. That's a little verse from G.K. Chesterton, and it sums up the conflict between the modern spirit and traditional Christian teaching that he was familiar with in the earlier part of this century. It had all begun, really, back in June 1860, when Bishop Wilberforce of Oxford had a public debate with Professor Huxley of Imperial College in London. The bishop's address relied more on polemic and oratory than on careful thought, and he ended it by asking Huxley, with heavy sarcasm, whether he claimed descent from a monkey through his grandmother or his grandfather. Huxley, in his reply, said that he would not mind a monkey for an ancestor, but he would be ashamed to be affiliated to a man who used great gifts to obscure the truth. Well, so the debate between Christian dogma and scientific theory began and has continued really up to the present day. Is man a naked ape, as evolution suggests, or is he the image of God, as the book of Genesis insists? So we said last week, the debate has been clouded in many ways by both sides overstating their case. Science has its limitations. Until the arrival of Doctor Who's time machine, there is no way science can comment on the origin of man and the universe without relying very heavily on speculation and unprovable assumptions. Experimental method is just not applicable to questions of history at the moment. Scientists haven't always recognized that limitation as candidly as they should. But then Christians have their limitations too. The Bible is a book that can't be understood without the employment of fallible human reason. It's possible to interpret the Bible wrongly, and there have been notable occasions when quite clearly this has been the case during history. Christians haven't always been prepared to accept the fact that they may make mistakes in their understanding of the Bible. Indeed, sometimes those who are the most zealous in denying infallibility of the Pope are the most zealous in claiming their own personal infallibility in this matter. Both scientists and Bible students have on occasions lacked the intellectual humility that's necessary to their disciplines. Controversy is always made more acrimonious by those who, when they're unable to strengthen their arguments, take refuge in simply shouting louder. And that, I'm afraid, is what has often happened. Well, this morning I want us to look at two things. First, I want us to look at the biblical account of the origin of man to see what conclusions, if any, we can come to about this debate that troubles so many people. Secondly, and more important in my view, I want us to look at the biblical account of the nature of man. Because while science may successfully tell us how a man works, and whilst it may presume to speculate on where man came from, science has proven in our century quite powerless to tell us who man is and why he's here. And that seems to me to be a much more important question. But let's begin with the origin of man. I don't want to run away from that issue. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7 says, "The Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being." There are two ways Christians have understood the story of Adam. Some have looked at it symbolically. They have understood it perhaps mythologically. For them, Adam symbolizes the human race in its early innocence before conscience developed. Others have understood it allegorically. They argue that Adam is symbolic of every individual human being. Each of us recapitulates the experience of Adam, his transition from innocence to guilt, in our own experience as we grow from childhood to adult maturity. And there are elements in the story, it has to be admitted, that lend support to a non-literal interpretation. The tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the talking serpent, They seem, at least to superficial glance, to have more in common with legend than with serious history. And as we said last week, the tree of life, that figure that occurs in verse 9, that reoccurs in the very last chapter of the Bible, in Revelation 22, a book which is absolutely full of symbolism. Nevertheless, it does seem to me there are very strong arguments in favour of understanding the story of Adam as that of a concrete historical individual. Let me tell you some of my reasons for suggesting that. The first is within the account itself, in chapter 2, verse 4. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created, the story begins. Now, if you study Genesis, you'll find that phrase recurs repeatedly throughout the book. And though its significance has been debated, there seem to me to be very good grounds for thinking that when it's included, it indicates that the material that follows on from it is an ancient source that the author of Genesis has incorporated into his text. Often, for instance, this phrase precedes a long genealogy, a list of ancestors, that is. You'll find a good example of that in chapter 10, verse 1. This is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, and then follows all the list of their descendants. Such a list would no doubt have been handed down, perhaps by word of mouth, or perhaps in written form, over generations. In tribal societies still today, you find they pay great attention to such ancient lore, and often learning such materials an important part of a child's education. Well, it was no doubt the same in the days of Moses. If we're correct in thinking that that's what the phrase "this is the account of" means, then you see it implies that this story has its roots in human memory. The writer isn't telling us a supernatural revelation he had, which we might want to call a vision or a piece of apocalyptic, such as perhaps Genesis 1 represents, some would argue. No, he's recounting us, under the supervising influence of the Holy Spirit, a story as old as man himself, which had been handed down through the patriarchs. And that, of course, helps us to understand why anthropologists discover that stories which seem to have some affinity to that of Adam and Eve are still told by ancient peoples, even today, in remote corners of the world. That's one thing that makes me think that there's history behind this account. Another argument in favour of treating the story as fundamentally historical is that the author identifies the Garden of Eden geographically. Do you notice that? In verse 8, he specifies that it was in the east, and he calls it Eden, a name which seems to have been derived from an ancient word meaning a plain or a platter. Then in verses 10 to 14, he actually defines four rivers that flowed out of it, two of which are well known even today, the Tigris and the Euphrates. It seems then that the Garden of Eden was located in the Near East, probably in the high steep lands of what's now called Turkey. It seems very odd to give that kind of information if the writer doesn't intend us to understand his story as literally true. But perhaps the most important argument in favour of a historical understanding of Adam is that the whole of the rest of the Bible assumes that Adam and Eve really existed. Luke, for instance, traces the genealogy of Jesus right back to Adam. Jesus himself speaks of Adam and Eve in terms of making it quite clear he regarded them as literal people. And the Apostle Paul argues that the universal nature of sin and of guilt in the world derive from our common historical roots in Adam. So to deny, you see, the historicity of Adam doesn't just affect our interpretation of this little passage in the book of Genesis. It places a question mark over the reliability of the whole Bible and a great many of the doctrines that the Bible teaches. So without wanting to outlaw Christians who in all good conscience hold other views, I want to suggest that we ought to say that Genesis 2 verse 4 onwards, at the very least, must be treated not as poetry or allegory or myth or apocalyptic or anything of that nature. It should be treated as a historical document, because that's what it seems to regard itself as. Now, of course, if we take that line, we have to ask ourselves the question, well, then how does that fit in with the account of human beginnings that modern science presents? We said last week that a Christian must believe that the descriptions of the scientist and the teaching of the Bible are in harmony. We can't afford to shut our eyes to awkward facts if they are genuinely facts. To do so is the denial of faith, not its affirmation. Where does Adam belong then in the observations scientists have made of the remains of early man? It's well known that archaeology has discovered bones which anatomically are classified as human, but which according to theories of dating we have now are over 1 million years old. Now I think we must begin by saying there is no way that this Adam can be as old as that if Genesis 2 is read as history. In chapter 5, there's a genealogy leading from Adam to Noah. And in chapter 11, the list is continued up to Abraham, allowing for the fact that these lists aren't complete and that the date of Abraham is not absolutely certain. That still means that according to Genesis, Adam must have existed somewhere between 5,000, say, and 10,000 BC. There's no way you can stretch the evidence to 1 million years BC. But then, you know, it would be most unrealistic if Genesis did place Adam that early. For you see, Genesis 2 makes it quite clear that Adam was an agriculturalist. He was put on the earth, we read, to till it. We read in chapter 4, verse 17, his son Cain built a city. And we read in chapter 4, verse 22, that his fairly close descendants forged bronze and iron. Now, in archaeological terms, that means that Adam was certainly a Neolithic man. According to the theories that archaeologists turn up, assuming just for a moment they're true, at the end of the last ice age, such men as existed, assuming they did exist and assuming they were men, were hunters living in caves. But then, for some reason which is not at all understood, after hundreds of thousands of years of this caveman existence, man suddenly began to farm. He built cities, he developed technology. And within quite a short space of time, he was working metals. What we call civilization began. It's assumed by evolutionists that there is a genetic link between this Neolithic man and the sort of men that preceded it. Though, of course, that can't be proven. And there's no explanation of this cultural revolution that quite suddenly descended on the world. But the date of that revolution can be made fairly accurately. Sometime around 8,000 BC. The place? Well, there's still a good deal of dispute about that, but there are good grounds for believing that Neolithic culture began in the Middle East. Some of the earliest Neolithic cities that have been discovered are actually in the high plateaus of Turkey. So you see, there's no difficulty in identifying where Adam belongs in the pattern of man's cultural development as we understand it. The problem, of course, is deciding what we are to make of those so-called human relics that scientists want to date earlier than Neolithic man, the farmer. Now, there are two approaches Christians explore in this regard, and it depends to a large extent on how they interpret Genesis 1, the issue we dealt with last week. One group want to argue that the dating methods that scientists use today are haywire, because they assume that there are no major discontinuities in nature since the origin of man. But there has been a major discontinuity, they say, the flood. Human fossil remains are the men, they say, who perished in that great catastrophe. They seem older because the geology of the earth was also transformed during that cataclysm. Now, this is the view that's commonly held by those who reject the evolutionary model completely and interpret the 7 days of Genesis 1 literally. On such a view, of course, there wasn't any world 1 million years BC, let alone human beings. The alternative view is espoused by those who accept, at least in broad outline, an evolutionary model. Though, as we said last week, they see it as the means God used to create his world rather than a succession of chance events. Now, according to this school of thought, the fossil remains are creatures who existed before Adam. Some of these Christians hold that they were man-like, highly developed animals, from which God perhaps took one specimen and transformed, not physically but spiritually, into the image of God. Others hold, I think with more plausibility, that there were men on the earth before Adam. They defend this view by pointing out that Genesis does recount two creations of man. The first, in Genesis 1, verse 26, let us make man in our image, and the second in Genesis 2. The Genesis 1 expression is man emerging at the end of the evolutionary chain that God had followed. This is man the hunter, they say. Man, if you like, a million years BC. But then much later come the events of Genesis 2. In verse 4, they say, we see a picture of the wasteland left in the Near East after the recession of the glaciers. A desert denuded of vegetation, but rich in alluvial soil. A desert man can just remember on the fringes of his racial memory, watered by frequent floods from the melting ice. It's at this point that God makes a new type of man, Adam, by special creation. Pre-Adamic men, they say, continued to exist. It was these fierce peoples that Cain feared when God banished him after he killed his brother. Whoever finds me will kill me, he said. It was these people, too, that he found his wife among. But all these pre-Adamic races perished with the flood, so that now only Adamic man is left, as the New Testament assumes. Well, there's a coherence in such a view which is appealing, but it's impossible to say which of these various approaches is the right one dogmatically. What I think we can and ought to say is that there's no insuperable conflict between scientific observations, such as we have them, of early men, and what Genesis 2 is telling us here. In fact, there's a great deal of congruency that makes a lot of sense. While some Christians, no doubt, will prefer to understand the story of Adam in a non-literal way, there are strong arguments, both within the Bible and outside it, to support a historical interpretation. And that's the view that we shall be following from Genesis 2, verse 4, onward in our studies in subsequent weeks. Well, so much for the technical questions that trouble so many people about the origin of man. If you'd like to go into them more deeply, there are three books here that I'm not recommending, I'm just pointing them out to you. This one, Man's Origin and Man's Destiny, is a book in support of the literal seven-day creation view. This book, Who Was Adam? By Victor Pierce, is a book that supports the view that Adam was Neolithic man and that pre-Adamic men existed. And this book, Adam and the Ape, by R.J. Berry, is a theistic evolutionist position. Now, if you would like to gen up further on these complicated issues, we shan't take more time in the pulpit to discuss them. Books are there and many others like them for you to read. But now I want to turn to what I said at the beginning was a much more important question. And that is the issue of the nature of man. You'll see this outlined for you in the white bulletin. Let me give you an illustration to explain why I say that this is a much more important question. Suppose I received a mysterious letter. It's written in an unknown hand, in a totally foreign language. It bears a very exotic stamp. I could give it to my scientific friends, and they no doubt would tell me a lot about my letter. They would do various tests on the ink to try to establish how long ago it was written. And they would probably finish up arguing about it, but at least they would give me some answers. They would examine the stamp and try to identify the country of origin. They might even look at the handwriting and present me with a personality profile of the author. But if I said to them, yes, that's all very interesting, but what does the letter say? They would probably shrug their shoulders. Oh, we don't know this language. It's completely unintelligible. As far as we can see, it's just a random collection of meaningless marks on the paper. You see, in the same way, scientists may express their learned opinions about when and where man began. But the most vital question for you and me is not the origin of man, but his meaning. What does the letter say? Why is he here? What is his significance? There's no way experiments on fossilized bones are going to help us answer that question. When scientists pass opinions on such matters, they are going beyond science, into the realm of philosophy and metaphysics, and yes, of religion. Yet, of course, there's no way we human beings can avoid asking such questions, because we are human beings. If we don't understand the meaning of man, it means we don't understand ourselves. And we demand such an understanding. whatever the truth about evolution may be, man is different from the animals in this, that he is not content simply to survive. He demands an understanding of himself, a purpose, a goal. He demands that his life should have a meaning, and science cannot tell him what that meaning is. It cannot read the letter. But Genesis can. Genesis can translate this mysterious epistle of our human existence and tell us what it says. When you don't understand a novel, you don't go to the critics. Not if you've got any sense. You ask the author. When you don't understand yourself, you don't ask the scientist. He's very likely as confused as you are. You ask the creator. And that's what we have here in Genesis. A word from God to explain to us just who we are. If we could have worked that question out by our science, God would not have needed to give us Genesis 1 and 2. He would have said, work it out for yourselves. But he has taken pity on our ignorance. No, he says, you're not just a highly developed ape. You are something special. When I made you in the image of myself. Now, don't get confused about that. That doesn't mean that man is pure spirit in the same way that God is. Oh, no, it's very clear. Man is material. He made him, we read in verse 7, out of the dust. So the chemicals of our bodies are indistinguishable from the bottles on the shelves of the inorganic chemistry laboratory down in the town. And he put the same sort of vitality in us as he did in the animals. He made us, we read in verse 7, a living being. That phrase is used in Genesis of any form of animal life, not just of man. But there's something more to man. Something godlike. What exactly does that phrase, image of God, imply? Well, if you look on the outline, I've listed there three aspects of human nature which are described for us in this passage, which I think all contribute to what the Bible means when it says that man is in the image of God. Rule, responsibility, and relationship. Let's look at those three. First of all, rule. This is the aspect of man's uniqueness that seems to be most obviously associated with the phrase image of God when it first occurs in verse 26. Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, this is chapter 1, sorry, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock and over all the earth. It's true, isn't it, that man does have an extraordinary ability to control the world around him. He hasn't got any predatory teeth or claws, yet it's he, not the lion, who's the real king of the world. He has little body hair, but he can survive in Arctic wastes as successfully as in equatorial heat. When animals find their environment changed, they adapt, if they can, or else they become extinct. The man has a mysterious ability to actually adapt his environment to his needs. He doesn't change, he changes the world around him. So successful is he in that, that he can live where no animal could survive for 5 minutes. In the inhospitable surface of the moon. It's popular to attribute this to man's intelligence. But if so, that intelligence is more than simply brain size. After all, dolphins have huge brains. You could argue that they were bigger brains than man on a sort of brain-to-weight ratio. But they don't rule the world as man does. Genesis says man demonstrates this extraordinary dominance because he possesses a measure of the wisdom and the creative genius of God himself. One of the reasons he was put on earth was to be God's deputy, his viceroy. We see this portrayed, I think, in a very profound way, as God brings the animals and birds to Adam in verse 19 of chapter 2. When he had formed them all, he brought them to the man to see what he would name them. I suppose naming seems a rather trivial affair to us. But you know, there's quite a lot to giving something a name. For a start, when you name something, it's often a mark of ownership, saying that it belongs to you. And I'm sure that was part of the significance of this prerogative that was given to Adam, to name the animals. In a sense, they were his, at his disposal. Another thing, of course, it does when you name something often, is to imply authority. I call my dog because I know his name. And often names had a similar significance in the Bible. Another thing which naming something implies, which is perhaps a little more subtle, it implies distinct personality. You know, in chapters 1, verse 8 to 10, we found God giving names to the sky and the seas and the land after he'd made them. That's important because it proved that God was distinct from nature. He stood apart from what he'd made, a personal being, self-consciously different from everything impersonal. And in the same way, Adam here is testifying to his sense of transcendence. By naming the animals, he objectifies them. He distinguishes his own unique existence from them and asserts himself as a self-conscious, personal agent. But perhaps the most interesting aspect of naming, as far as Adam goes here, is that it implies a certain measure of rational analysis. When you name animals like this, you have to recognize similarities between them. Oh yes, there are two dogs there. You have to classify your environment. What we have actually here is the beginning of the scientific enterprise. You must never think that a science is something necessarily godless, because it's sometimes been the tool of godless philosophy. It began right here in the Garden of Eden, when man began to name his world. And that process of naming has gone on as man's observation of his environment has become more and more complete and more sophisticated. All science is at root nothing more than classifying what we see, identifying phenomena that have got something in common, and uniting them under a common name. It's a descriptive exercise, and it's an exercise God has given a man a mandate to perform. One of the things about Eastern religion, for instance, is that it imparts a superstitious reverence for nature. And that inhibits man's willingness to control his environment and to develop science. Hinduism teaches that there is no ultimate distinctions in the universe. Everything's a manifestation of a cosmic spirit. Everything's divine. And the result is, of course, that people go hungry rather than kill the rats and the cows and eat the corn. Science can never develop in a worldview like that, a pantheistic worldview. It would be essentially irreligious. To name things, to distinguish yourself from them, is to deny the oneness of everything. It's an extraordinary irony, I think, that science, which so many people today seem to regard as the great enemy of the Bible, could never have grown up unless the Bible had taught man this worldview, rather than the nature mysticism that he followed before it dawned upon him. Some, of course, would argue it would be a jolly good job if science hadn't developed. They point to all the ecological catastrophes and so on that man's undisciplined use of technology is producing. Wouldn't it be better if we did have a less superior, more mystical, more reverential attitude towards nature, they say? Perhaps then we wouldn't abuse it so much. I think their criticism's ill-judged. See, the reason in the 20th century science has become an agent of destruction is not because man was wrong to feel himself the monarch of the universe. No, it's because that rule has become divorced from something which, according to Genesis, must go with it. Responsibility. Look at verse 16 and 17. The Lord God commanded the man, "You are free, but..." Life was easy in the garden. Everything man needed was laid on, so to speak. Verse 9 speaks about all kinds of trees, trees that were pleasing to the eye. That is, things to satisfy our appreciation for beauty, our aesthetic awareness, our love of art, if you like. Trees that were good for food, things to satisfy our physical appetites. Everything man needs for nutrition and health was there. And the tree of life was there too. What was needed to satisfy man's spiritual aspirations, his personality, his hunger for immortality, was all there. And man was free, we're told, to enjoy this paradise completely. God wanted him to enjoy it. There are some who seem to suggest that austerity is somehow more spiritual than pleasure. That's not so. Everything that God made, we're told, was good. The world was there for man to benefit from and to enjoy. Man wasn't even limited to the garden's boundaries, we're told. Outside, in verse 10, a world was waiting. A world of adventure. New lands to explore, new mineral resources to discover, gold and onyx and pearls. And there was work to do too. The garden must be tilled and cared for. The world must be subdued and filled. We tend to think of work as drudgery, don't we? We distinguish it from leisure and try to maximize the latter. But it's not meant to be so. Man was not made to be idle. And I think any one of us who's experienced unemployment for any length of time can testify to the truth of that. Work is a blessing, a means of human fulfillment, a way a man expresses his stewardship of the world. This great orbit of permission, then, which God gave to man at the beginning. You are free, he said. Over this whole idyllic environment, God placed only one restriction, one but. But you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. People have tried to identify exactly what eating this tree indicated. Sometimes it's been suggested there was some sexual connotation. Others say it represents some sphere of prohibited knowledge, as something man was not allowed to investigate, like the occult, for instance. Now, the truth is we're not told, because the tree surely is simply there to indicate that man's freedom must be conditional freedom. By the very nature of man's creaturehood, it is liberty under law. Man is free to do as he ought, not to do as he wants. Man rules, yes, but his rule is limited by the sovereignty of the God who delegated that rule to him in the first place. The reason our world is in a mess is because men are not content with the humble dignity of being made in the image of God. In our arrogance, we have grasped at deity itself. We want no inhibitions to our freedom of action, no limitations to our liberty. We want moral autonomy. We want not just to rule the world, but to rule ourselves as well. And there, I say, is the root of your ecological crises and your economic collapses. There's the poison that destroys our longed-for utopias. That's why our lives individually are in a mess. That's why your life is in a mess. Because we do not want to be commanded. We do not want to admit the existence of a God who can command us. God said, "You are free, but..." We have replied, "No, I am free, full stop." No buts. People talk, you know, so much rubbish about free will. At least they do these days, they never used to. Don't you realize that the liberty of free will is sin? That's exactly what sin is, free will. It's the shame of humanity that we live as if we could choose. Choose outside the will of God. True freedom is not a choice between alternatives. True freedom is obedience. We are free only so long as we agree with God. If we choose to disagree with God, in the day we eat thereof, we die. You want to find fulfillment and satisfaction. You want to find paradise. And you as I must learn to accept that we are responsible creatures. A fellow once said to me, when I said this to him, he said, "Oh, well, I'm responsible to myself." Have you ever heard such rubbish? Such mutilation of the English language? How can you be responsible to yourself? You can only be responsible to someone. You can't have imperatives in the first person singular. The word "ought" only makes sense when it comes from above to us. We can't construct it for ourselves. No, we must let God tell us what is right and wrong and stop making up the rules for ourselves. He has things for you and me to enjoy. He has work for you and me to do. But we will miss it all till we bow our proud heads and accept his moral restrictions on our lives. This is what marks us out as animals. We don't live by instinct. Like God himself, we have a conscious will to plan and to choose. This is our distinctive human dignity. God made us not a machine, but a responsible moral person. And for that reason, and that reason alone, we may live in paradise or hell. But we haven't said all there is to say from this chapter about the uniqueness of man and what it means for him to be the image of God. He displays rule. He displays responsibility. But there was a third thing. Relationship. Look at verse 18. The Lord God said, "It is not good for man to be alone." God had examined every corner of his universe before this, and it was all, we read, good. But now suddenly we find a different verdict. Something is not good. Man is lacking something. Something no tree in the garden could give him. Because it wasn't a something, it was a someone. Bible students have often noted the strange use of the plural pronoun back in chapter 1, verse 26. God said, "Let us make man in our image." Often it's been said that that's simply a Hebrew idiom to indicate the power of God, rather like the royal we that Queen Victoria was so fond of. Well, we could be satisfied with that explanation if it weren't for the fact that there's precisely the same oscillation between singular and plural used of the image of God in verse 27. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. There's a clear implication there, you see, that to adequately image God, there had to be more than one person. That male and female together constitute the image of God. And that is quite conclusively proven in chapter 5. Verses 1 and 2, where we read, "When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them, male and female, at the time they were created. He blessed them and called them man." Long ago, St. Augustine defended the doctrine of the Trinity by suggesting that since God was love, then from all eternity there must have been someone there for him to love. Because love can only exist in the context of an interpersonal relationship. Are we speculating too far, I wonder, to say that God's sensitivity to Adam's loneliness is due to just that? It is not good for man to be alone. No. For man is the image of God. And God has never known what loneliness was. From all eternity, God has had company. The image of God, you see, wasn't fully reflected till God had taken man and divided him into male and female, till man, like God, was able to love another person. Do you notice in verse 23, Adam gives the woman a name, just as he has to the animals. She belongs to him. He has authority over her as the one who was created before her. He separates himself from her as a self-conscious individual, a distinct personality. And yet at the same time, because she shares his human substance, because she is bone of bone and flesh of his flesh, he's incomplete without her. And there is the possibility of a union between these two persons which was not possible with any other aspect of creation. There are many lessons we could learn from verse 24 about the nature of marriage. "For this reason," he says, "a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they become one flesh." We could draw lessons about the importance of a young couple leaving parental control. We could also, I think, draw validly the conclusion that marriage was not primarily intended just for procreation, that a marriage is complete without children. And there's perhaps comfort there for childless couples, that the original intention of marriage was to provide company, not posterity. But I think the most important thing we conclude from these closing verses of chapter 2 is this, that that complex of relationships that we call the family is not some accident of social evolution, as many people are suggesting these days. It is part of our image of God nature. God himself exists in a complex of relationships, and our marriages and families are meant to reflect the same sort of love that glues the Godhead together. The man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. So you see, no suspicion tormented this relationship. No lust brutalized it. Self-consciousness could not make it artificial. Chapter 2 ends with man in total harmony with himself, with his world, with his God. The tragedy is that it's a past tense. They were both naked. There's a pathos here, you see, that man should have such bliss and throw it away. Rule, responsibility, relationship. What more do you want? This is what man was intended to be. What more do you want? Independence. Independence of God. That's what we wanted. And so the dignity we possessed, we lost. Yet still we can have it. Still we can be the sort of human beings that God made us to be. We are not past redemption. Paul tells us, put off your old self and put on your new self, which in Christ Jesus is being renewed in the image of the Creator. The reason Jesus Christ came was that you and I might find again the dignity and the glory, not of being angels strumming harps on clouds, the dignity and glory of being men, real men, made in the image of God. Let's pray together.